brief, I'll just mention that in, we also appreciate your concern about the issues of the target, as we said, and the president will give the details thereof. But just to mention, as we have said in the previous slides, that indeed the targets that are being given, they are clearly going to the previously disadvantaged group by more than half. If you look at a total of 156 people that have gotten the bursaries, for instance, you realize that the whites have only been a third of it. So two-thirds would be then constituted by blacks, and then out of those two-thirds, the African females would be then the majority of it, out of there. So clearly two-thirds, but further on, to break it down, it's African females that are in the majority. And then the issue of the rural, yes, as the president has mentioned, the previous presentation that we had, actually we try to actually partner with places like Walter Sisulu, Porte, University of Limpopo, and Swakopmund Makgatho, as institutions that would mostly have people that are from the previous disadvantaged institutions. And that effort is ongoing, and of course, out of those two that we might want to then say, these are from this specific province, but that will not necessarily be now, but definitely can assure that it is the previously disadvantaged, and we are making an effort to reach out for those that are really from the previous background. And the termination of the, or rather the resignation of the former vice president had not necessarily come at an expense or unnecessarily expenditure to the MRC. It was only a 3-month payout that had happened, which is before the board and the management that was a normal process to follow. And then of course we did wish the Professor Stefan, Professor Olak, in departing the MRC. And just again, in terms of the usage of terminology, again, we appreciate that and we will clearly be consistent and use it appropriately as African, colored, and Indians, and of course, not have a mixture. And then the details of in the other matters.
No, not me. I think someone got very angry. Maybe the ITCOM. I'm going to ask some of my. Thank you, Honourable Chair and Honourable Members. I'm going to address some of it and then also ask my team to comment as well. In terms of whether we whether our indicators are we overachievers? Or have we set our indicators too low? So every year we have adjusted our indicators based on our previous performance to improve over and above our previous year. When we do benchmarks with the CSIR, HSRC, ARC, we are definitely outperforming our other science councils in South Africa, despite that we have a lower budget than some of them. When we peer review our publications with the Indian Medical Research Council, the Russian Academy of Medicine, the Brazilian equivalent, and the Chinese Academy of Medicine, we find that we are, if we adjust for our budget, we are more value for money than what you see in Brazil, China, Russia, or India. So I will, we can send that data. It's very nice when you look at the budget. You can see that we get bang for our buck, and we are really are happy about that. So obviously we're proud about our productivity because we know that if we are publishing in high impact science journals, that those journals become policy. Those articles become policy. When you publish in the NEJM or the Lancet, and you publish on a clinical trial, the ministry, the Department of Health, are more likely to implement an intervention that comes from a high-impact journal than something that comes from another journal. So in terms of the evidence, the EDL group and the ministry the Minister's Advisory Committees on Cancer Immunization will look at the high-impact journals, and based on those, will implement the evidence in clinical practice. So that is one way of making why it's important to publish in high-impact journals. because not only will people, not only will people in South Africa, the NDOH, take note, but we will change policy all over the world. And certainly South African science has changed policy not only here, but in America. It's changed CDC guidelines and changed WHO guidelines. And so there is value in publishing in high impact journals. So we continue. We want our scientists to publish. It's good for our status, and it also makes impact. So we do think that we are not overachievers, and we want our scientists to even publish better than they have been publishing. In terms of the issue around affordability, so there were two questions on affordability. One was on cancer research, and one was on the quadruple burden disease, particularly around non-clinical diseases, hypertension, about the affordability of drugs. And because pharma make money on drugs, we've invested in a drug discovery program that goes through compounds. So we have one of the biggest drug discovery programs under Kelly Chabali. And with that program, already we've identified two malaria compounds that are entering human development. And if these two malaria compounds are active, we can give it to people at an affordable level, and we won't have to pay the big money that Novartis or something else will address. So it's very important that we fund drug discovery. Sometimes we may not be lucky, but if we fund drug discovery, we can discover the compounds that can make a difference. And in that way, we also have this, we have a group that are people that are working in diabetes. And from rooibos tea, they've identified a metabolite that can control diabetes. So we're busy evaluating this metabolite. And if this metabolite works, we own it, and which means it can be distributed for an affordable price. So we are very interested in trying to find local drugs, local screening, so that we can drop the prices of treatment down. So in terms of cancer, we are funding precision medicine in cancer to try and find genes that can help us do drug targets that can help also again drive the price of drugs down. So that's a long term process, but we are committed to drug discovery so that we can bring prices down. Nick's going to talk about post-retirement medical aid and the overpayment for the board members. And the former, just to clarify, on the former the contract was a 3-month resignation period, so we never lost money because we just fulfilled the 3-month resignation period of that contract, and so it didn't cost us any money. In terms of research to combat health, how, what on earth all the stuff that we're funding doesn't actually help the man in the street? And the MRC funds everything from blue sky research to things that can help the man in the street. So we do everything from the cradle to the grave, or from the bench to the bedside to the community. And so some examples, so I mentioned the diabetes that might be 10 years away, or the cancer treatment that might be 15 years ago. But in terms of what impact do we have now, definitely the AmbiFlow is something that is going to change the trajectory of stillbirths, not only in South Africa, but in other low and middle income countries. So we're very proud of that AmbiFlow. But even that, it was from 1970 that we've been developing this program, and only now we're beginning to see its benefits. So sometimes innovation in health takes time. In terms of other things that benefit nurses, kangaroo, mother care, so developing low affordable interventions for preterm delivery, things like kangaroo mother care, we've evaluated and rolled it out in the hospitals. The skin-to-skin contact, understanding the microbiome and the importance of human contact. So all those things, although they may not cost thousands, just teaching a mom to put a baby on her chest can save that baby's life. And so those are the kind of the interventions that may not look, that have a huge impact, but they continue to do. Rachel will talk a little bit more about the work that we do in violence and injury, and working from ground up. So violence and injury is a huge problem, a huge burden of disease. and we work with communities to try and find local solutions that work for that community, and Rachel will talk a little bit more about it. So sometimes it looks like we're just funding blue sky research, but the apps that we make for the Department of Health, the UmbiFlow, Kangaroo Care, and some of the gender-based programs and that work, do address some of the things that impact people. We also try and focus on the social determinants of disease, and in our programs look at drug abuse, alcohol use, and other issues that affect mental health. So those kind of things may not get the high impact journals, but definitely work to solve solutions at a grassroots level, and Rachel will talk a little bit more about that later. In terms of NAPISA, we have worked very closely with the department, I think very closely, with the Department of Health. So we've had numerous meetings, both with the DG, UNBUN. We've written communications to them. We've gone word by word through the Act. We've responded publicly to the Parliamentary Committee on Health. We were given an opportunity to, again, go through the Act to look at. And we, first and foremost, what we want to say is we're incredibly committed to NAPISA, and we believe that NAPISA needs to exist. And we would like to work with NAPISA to make sure that the limited scarce skills that we have in this country, we work together with, so that everything we do is synergistic and not competitive. We have a very small pool of people, and we want to work well and synergistically with NAPISA. And so we have gone through their act, and we have gone through our act, and we've looked at areas where there's a potential overlap or confusion. And we believe that with the Department of Health, you know, we can work out specifically, how we work with NAPISA so that we add value to the country instead of steal each other's resources. And so we committed to it, and we think it's an essential structure that needs to happen. We need surveillance. We need to understand better the kind of things that cause South Africans to be not to be healthy. So we are committed, and we'll work. Already we fund the National Cancer Registry, and so we're committed to funding them. And already we fund a lot of the work that NRCD does, and we'll continue to work with them on lots of projects. So we have a healthy relationship with NHLS and a healthy relationship with NRCD, and I don't see why we can't continue in terms of our working together and having a good understanding of what each of us should do so that we don't duplicate and waste money. In terms of the feminization of medical science, yes, it's true that medical science is so highly feminized. It's one of the only aspects of science that is so feminized. But what we see is a fallout of women in the senior leadership. So that in the mid-career, there's lots of women in medical research, but then they fall out. And so what we want to do is retain them and not let them fall out. And they don't fall out if you mentor them, you support them, you understand that they have more than just the role of being a scientist. They have a role of being a caretaker, look after children, after aging parents. And so we have to be flexible in the way we work with women so that we can make sure that they are optimized and we don't lose them lose them and that we develop them. So I think we're committed to developing women in senior structures in the MRC. In terms of consistency use of terms, we will address it. I'd like to say that my slides, I had the correct terms, and the HR got it wrong. I'm playing with you. But also to say that if we have anything in the budget that we want to increase, is I would like to double our capacity development. So from 55 million, I'd like to see 100 million. 100 million rand going to PhDs, postdocs, and developing the mid-career scientists so that we can move them to become senior scientists. You know, very soon, my term ends. We need to make sure that we have people coming in the pipeline, and so we need to develop and invest in a very proactive way in the mid-career to senior scientist level, as well as the junior scientist. So I would like our budget to increase in terms of capacity development. And I also want to make sure that we continue to to, in terms of budget, that we continue to increase our support of HDIs and increase and help them grow science. And we've done quite well. You know, we have an extramural unit in University of Fort Hare, and that extramural unit director has just been nominated into the Academy of Science. Very good publisher. You know, we developed an HIV vaccine clinical trial site at Mthatha University. We developed research in emergency medicine in East London, and we've shown that both at MUT, where we invested in schistosomiasis hookworm research, and in University of Venda, we've seen an SMU, we've seen that these projects can flourish. And so if I'm going to ask for more money, I'm going to ask for more money for the HDR programs and for capacity development, because we've seen with just a little bit of money what we can do, and we can do a lot more with lots more money. In terms of the contractual, you asked about the contractual issues. So science is contractual. People write a grant, and it's going to take us 4 years to do the clinical trial, or 3 years to do the experiment. And so we can only employ scientists for that 3 years or 4 years while that work is being done. If we gave them a permanent job, there might not be work for them after those 3 or 4 years. And so in those 3 or 4 years, what our aim is that those people that we employ in those contracts become independent scientists themselves. We bring in their own contracts and bring in their own money and bring in their own science and their own grants. And so we have had a legal opinion, and we have a program where we have what we call indefinite contracts. So the contract will last the duration of the study or the research. And so most research is 4 or 5 years, and those contracts will be between 3 to 5 years, and they'll be indefinite. And legally, I think we're fine. And maybe the lawyer and HR expert can talk about that. In terms of irregular expenditure, Mongezi will talk about it. And I'm going to ask the other people we have missed, just to add. But let's go on to Brinton, because you're going to talk about the decrease in the amount of colours that have been appointed.
Honourable Chair, I kind of feel like I've excuse myself from answering because I'm conflicted. But I've got an answer on behalf of the collective. No. Chair, the reason for it, I think, lies in history. That in the time gone by, we were ahead of space in the Western Cape, which is the predominantly coloured. And what we've done is taken a strategic decision to shift from a focus on regional demographics to the national demographics. And so it's really just part of a balancing. But we're doing it within the restrictions of the law, i.e. we don't just fire people because we're creating post fathers. It's by a process of natural attrition, and certainly in a positive way by providing opportunities for the other groups to come in. So that's how we're doing it. Thank you.
So, Honourable Chairperson, I'll answer the one or two questions. The first one was the issue around the post-retirement medical aid and the pension fund. There's quite a detailed explanation on page 184 of the annual report, but essentially these are what we call legacy liabilities. Okay, so on the retirement medical aid, certain of our older staff members are entitled to a subsidy of their medical aid contributions post-retirement. So what the MRC did at the time, it took some funds and invested them with an insurance company so that when these people retired, the money would be there to fund the liabilities. However, because of the medical inflation has been so high, we've all seen how medical inflation has outstripped normal inflation, the actuaries have said that the liability exceeds the asset. So to the extent that the liability exceeds the asset, we have to bring the liability onto the MRC balance sheet in terms of the accounting rules. So that's what we've done. So that makes up 7.1 million rand of the 12 million liability. Fortunately, however, the last person entitled to that benefit is now retired, so this liability has now peaked, and will start to, obviously based on mortality, will start to reduce over time. The second area is the pension fund, the defined benefit obligation to our defined benefit members. We have two funds. We have a defined contribution fund, where 90-odd% of our staff members are members. And in the defined contribution fund, the members take the investment risk. In the defined benefit fund, however, the MRC takes the investment risk. So to the extent so again it relates to older members of the organization. So to the extent that the liabilities offset the assets again, we have to bring that liability onto the balance sheet. So based on salary increases having been in excess of inflation for these members, the liability has exceeded the assets by 4.8 million rand. So that actually makes up the 12 million. And again, this liability is ring-fenced, and we are, together with our head of legal, in discussion with these defined benefit members in an effort to ensure that this liability does not increase any further. Then the next question is the overpayment of board members, and that is also detailed on note 32, page 202. Essentially what happened, it dates back to 2015-16, where every year National Treasury issues a circular showing different bands and what board members are entitled to. However, before you increase to the next band, we should have actually got the approval of the Minister of Health, which in fact we didn't. So to that extent, we've raised what we call a contingent asset of 113,000 rand. That's what's potentially owed. So to the extent we don't get permission from the DOH, we will recover the funds from the board members. However, we are reasonably assured of that we will receive a favourable response from the Department of Health. And lastly, on the note, the issue on irregular expenditure, I'd like to ask Dr. Mbluli to Mangethe Mbluli to answer this question. Dr. Mbluli, before his appointment to Chief Research Operations Officer, was head of supply chain management and has been one of the key contributors to our clean audit. As you know, if procurement, there's a problem in procurement, you'll lose clean audit very quickly. So I think Dr. Mbluli is very well equipped to answer this question.
Thank you, Mr. Beard. Thank you, Chair and members. Just extend quickly on the irregular expenditure. This dates back to an audit finding of 2014-15 relating to one tender captured under note 38 in page 216 on the incorrect application of the preferential procurement regulations of 2011. In this regard, the MRC used a certain section of the Preferential Procurement Policy Framework Act, which relates to objective criteria. So in this case, we used a functional different objective criteria, and we combined points for price as well as functionality to come to a point where we are on the service provider. So the Auditor General said it was incorrect to apply that, and it was classified as an irregular expenditure. So you would note, Chair, that from 2016 to 2017, the irregular expenditure decreased from 1.4 million to about 484,000. So this contract will be coming to an end in this financial year. We have already advertised a tender for that contract, and we are now applying the regulations 2017 that were issued earlier this year on February. And interestingly enough, MRC was also a contributor to the regulations that are already promulgated by National Treasury. Thank you, Chair.
Chair, I want to just give you a bit more information about work that's done, which is reaching out and involving rural areas, and also the work which is influencing both problems faced by people on the ground within the communities, as well as experienced by health workers. And Professor Gray has talked about Umbiflow and kangaroo care. I think those are the important parts of maternal and child health. And efforts we're making to address this problem, which very clearly is faced by health workers within maternity facilities around stillbirth and around care of premature babies. But there are a number of other areas. We've been funding a project to strengthen the health systems in Limpopo on maternal and child health care, and that's been funded as part of one of our initiatives with Sweden. And we have a whole range of work around trying to translate the peer-reviewed journal article findings into very practical guidelines for health workers around care. And that's being driven by the Cochrane Centre. and our health systems research unit is also looking at how we understand the research that's being done on how to strengthen health systems and organise health worker staffing and responsibilities. And they've been developing guidelines based on the knowledge that's been developed and published within the peer review literature. So this is a very clear translational process from the peer review literature into knowledge which has applicability either through the Department of Health or in terms of health workers functioning on a daily basis. And we also have a lot of public health areas of work which are developing knowledge and from that communication materials that relate to a wide range of different people and communities. Our environmental and health group has been particularly looking at the issue of lead toxicity, and two key areas they've been focusing on have been lead in paint, which led to a considerable amount of policy-related work around taking lead out of paint, and also the issue of lead affecting people who are, that their work's been based in shooting ranges, but essentially people who handle firearms. And that impacts our entire security sector in this country, all of our police, all of our military, and has and the finding that these people actually have very high levels of blood lead and therefore are vulnerable to the toxicity, or will be experiencing the toxicity of this very important metal, is very, very important. And they've been doing work around trying to introduce preventive strategies to reduce exposure. That unit has also been focusing on heat, and as we sit in Cape Town having this meeting, we're very, very well aware of the impact of climate change. And one of the, particularly in the rest of the country, one of the important impacts has been extraordinary high levels of temperatures that have been experienced in recent years. And this has incredible impact on people both within housing, particularly in places like the Northern Cape, and bearing in mind that our basic RDP housing doesn't include ceilings, so there is no insulation, there's no protection under those metal roofs. And also within, for example, our health facilities, very often people experience very high temperatures while they're sitting waiting to see healthcare workers. The other people we're particularly concerned about are all outdoor workers, every farm worker in the country who has to work during the hot hours of the day, every construction worker in the country, and particularly those who work in places like KwaZulu-Natal, which are exceptionally humid, because the temperature which are tolerable to the human body before you encounter difficulties in humid areas are very much lower temperatures than in drier parts of the country. And so they've been doing research, synthesizing research and developing guidelines that actually impact very large sectors of our communities. And then the other area of work has been in the area of gender-based violence, which is a tremendous problem in our country. And I think particularly in the month of August, we always focus on violence against women. And this month, this year in particular, there have been many cases of the murder of women by intimate partners that really captured the emotions of the country. And my own unit at the MRC has been doing work to try and measure that, to look at the trends, and to answer the question which is asked all the time, why is this happening within our families and communities in South Africa? And we've been trying to look at that. And our unit runs a big research program to try and prevent violence against women. And at the moment, we're particularly focusing on work in two areas, in Deep Sluit and in the informal settlements around Etiquini, because we know that in informal settlements, there is more than twice the risk of exposure to rape and partner violence, and in fact, all forms of violence than there is in other areas. And so the question about what we can do to address the structure and gender-based drivers there are very important. And we're also doing work in schools, developing materials, which have been tried in schools in Shwane. But over the years have worked with different NGOs in community sectors, in different parts of the country, including Masisukumeni, which I think must be in, which is in the Tonga area, which must be near where you came from. And that's one of the places that we've been working. So that our violence work in particular works with the NGO community, because they are in the forefront of the work to improve, reduce violence in community and improve people's lives.
No, thanks very much. Oh, there's still another one. Okay.
Thank you, Chair, and Honourable Comrade, Honourable Member, sorry. Just to add, in one of the areas, there is the neglected tropical infections. These infections are neglected globally, but South Africa has been lagging behind most of the countries because, for one, it has been the only country that could not produce data on where the country sits in terms of the neglected tropical infections, the worm infections per se. It's always been assumed that South Africa doesn't have a problem, but for the first time, the country will be able to provide such data to the WHO, because the MRC has actually funded the only and the first national survey on worm infections among school children. And this has also prompted the Department of Basic Education to actually start rolling out deworming treatment on quintiles 1 up to 3 in the schools, because it has been shown that these infections are actually highly prevalent, and we are seeing numbers that we never thought we'd be able to see in 2017. Aligned to that, the recent demographic survey is actually came up with the finding that we still have a lot of stunting in children. So out of the funding from the MRC, the parasitology group is also trying to see whether the stunting that has been observed is actually linked to the highly prevalent parasitic infection. So this cuts across all sectors, particularly rural and informal settlement school children who are highly affected by these infections. So in terms of the reaching out into the disadvantaged communities, I think the MRC is actually making inroads even in areas that have been always been neglected. Thank you, Chair.
No, thanks very much. I see some follow-up to me, Dr. Meisner.
Yeah, thank you, Chair. Something struck me when Prof was talking about schistosoma, or schistosomiasis. Are we still having that? I haven't heard of that for a long, long time. And the second one is that, is there any way you can come up with a formula that will get children out of malnutrition? Children are still dying of malnutrition in South Africa. We picked it up when we were doing oversight. And it's a crime to let children die of malnutrition in the era of plenty. And maybe your unit can concoct a formula that can be used quickly once the malnutrition is picked up. Because otherwise it is doing the same thing as usual. So if that formula can be found, somewhere in Uganda they were doing that type of thing of having a formula with sugar, simsim, and peanuts, something like that, and it helps. Up in a week's time, a child is rescued from inevitable death by doing that. That is what we call on the ground level type of research that will save lives immediately, not in future. Thank you.
Let me talk about schistosomiasis, but you're right about the stunting, and that is the importance of doing surveillance and doing demographic surveys, because you pick up stuff that we may not be aware of. And so the stunting was a huge shock to everybody, including the Department of Health, because we thought that that was under control.
And so now that we know that this continues to be a problem, we, you know, we got diverted by lots of things. So now we can go back and say, okay, what are we doing wrong? What are we doing right? And where are those things that I used to use at Barak Warren Hospital, in that we used to concoct with peanut butter and oil, and they used to work very well. And to start to reintroduce some of these things, and certainly the stunting happens at the time of weaning, and what we're not doing is making sure that babies are getting the additional nutrients that they need at the 6 month period. And that 6 months to 18 months, that stunting is critical, and it impacts on cognitive development and all that. So it's something that we need to re-engineer, and that we had kind of got diverted by everything else. But Lungia, maybe you can just talk a little bit about schistosomiasis.
Thank you, Chair. The data will be released soon. However, there is data out there that has come out, especially in the August, in the South Coast region, because the schistosomiasis has always been in pockets, and high prevalence has been seen from the northern, the Mpumalanga, KZN, down the south as the Transkei. But we have seen a shocking result, up to 60% of the school children in those areas, especially where there is high water contact. And the third thing is that there has been, you know, reasonable and biologically plausible suggestions that it actually increases the susceptibility to HIV when you look at the pathological sequelae, when the eggs lodge in the urogenital tract, and they also resist the praziquantel treatment. The treatment kills the worm, but the eggs, as soon as they lodge there, they can be up to 25 years in the system, and it actually causes inflammatory response in the genital tract, such that when the children start becoming sexually active, the environment is just ripe for the HIV and all the other STIs. Actually, the study in the OWI has actually looked at the female genital schistosomiasis, and you find children as young as 12 years old having symptoms that are mistaken as STI infections because of the presentation. There's blood in the urine, there's discharge and everything, and these children are virgins. So it's shown that once these children become sexually active, the chances of contracting HIV are five times higher than the person who's never had schistosomiasis. It's not only schistosomiasis, even the worm burdens that we see in the children that are participating in the survey. Some of the schools, actually almost all the children are infected. So it is, as also it's been shown, that due to the nature of the chronicity of these infections and the constant activation of the immune response, actually may be linked to contracting HIV later in life. So there is data that shows that the problems are still there, it's just that we've not been looking for them because we've been sidelined by the big three, the HIV, TB and malaria, and we've largely neglected these infections. And also similar findings for adults. We've done several studies that show that even adults, up to 40% in informal settlements or in rural areas where sanitation and water supply is a challenge, with children up to 50 to 60% get infected in these conditions. So it perpetuates the transmission cycle because we know the oral fecal route. There's no water, then there's defecating, and then it goes to the water supply. The cycle is perpetuated through generations. So the latest survey that is being undertaken is actually going to give the national picture, and hence interventions hopefully will be targeted at that. And linked to that, there are also attempts to link the deworming to the school nutrition as an effort, because probably you try to feed the child, you're only feeding the worm. So we're making efforts to link the two so that we try to combat malnutrition to a certain extent. Because we know the worm infections also perpetuate malnutrition. Thank you.
No, thanks very much. I hope that the issues that you said are going to provide feedback. And then maybe at some point we not part of the report. Maybe at some point we'll have to invite you back, just have a discussion around the work that you're doing on the challenges of Thailand. Because it's become a big problem. You know what's happening currently. Just one example. There's a lot of violence that is taking place. The conduct of ourselves as South Africans is not time. If you can have an understanding. What in terms of the research findings, what does that mean to that? To stop this thing, but continuously becoming a serious challenge in society, in our country. And now he has taken it in political. Retreating back to the aliens. So we have to do something now. We can't continue. So maybe at some point we need to come back and present to us the research that we've done around the issue of injuries. What is that means to how do you relate this information that you said in the law industry so that they also plan the understand what are the causes and what is practice so that you don't do your own research and then they are doing their own knowledge. It should be that collaborative so that we are able to pull our heads together and see what we are beginning to reduce this sketch of violence and injustice and target our country. As I was telling you that the chair is not around, and I was joking to say there was a festival of chairs in the conference where you never expected people to be throwing at each other chairs. But that's the characterization of the society that we are. And if that emanates, I mean, you find itself now showing at the political level, we might believe it. Because if it goes to that level, as a country, we must know that we are not. So it's a very serious matter that you need to No, thanks very much. We will come to the end of our meeting. We'll request the members to remain behind. Have some few in-house teaching issues that we must deal with. I'm told that dinner is 6:30 in the old hall. If you'll be able to be around, you can join us. Thank you.
All the family. Half a seat. What's the time now? Yeah, we can go. Why?
We can go up.
I'm better.
Within a week, a child gets out of malnutrition condition and survives. In a week.
No, thanks very much. We wanted to indicate that tomorrow we will be dealing with three reports from three. One for Office of the Health Standard Compliance, CMS, and NHLS. There is three. Daniel report that you and then a call that we talked to will be confirmed. So we are unable to meet we'll meet them next week for the annual report. On Friday we're supposed to meet and deal with the medical innovation. But because of the department not available, we have to finalize the affair. And because we have not yet even engaged the IT, we are shifting it. It won't be next week. We'll see when I'm going to come back to it. It won't be next week because I have been mandated to engage with IFP on the net and the whole of next week I'm going to pressure for an ACT European. So those are the things. Then the last one, colleagues, but besides that, even if you wanted to, it was not going to be possible because you've got an invitation that we are required to attend a high level parliamentary meeting on achieving health targets and leaving no one behind. We are invited by Pan-African panel on Thursday. So we are proposing then that it has been already been approved by the House Chair for 5 members. Unfortunately, the Chair was supposed to lead the delegation. And I am also leaving to attend to the other political issues that I am supposed to be attending for Thursday, and also preparing them on Saturday or even on Saturday, and then prepare to leave on Saturday. So it won't be possible for me to be there on Thursday. So we're proposing that first the members who are in Calcutta, Honorable Dr. Maisel, first be the one that must attend, and then get the other 3 volunteers to add to the number to five who are ready to attend that function. Or Dr. Kembe Wine, who said two results are available, said for 3 already. So unless the DA unless anybody or anyone wants to attend, we make 4. Because we've got 3 already. 2 from the ANC, 1 from EFF, Dr. Kembe Wine. Anybody from the fine. You can indicate not today but now. This is the first thing in the morning tomorrow. Okay. But there's nothing that we will stop you or Gonzo if you are available to attend as well. To the 5th one. Because it makes 5. Oh, approve 3.
Yeah.
4, okay. And that's by the 4 plus 1. Oh, they are told the House Chair is approved for 3. So already for 3, so it's closed.
That's good.
Yeah. So we're already at the time. So the matter is very closed. Okay. The details then you will get from Kumbaya. Traveling and all other accommodation and all those stuff, you get it from by those two, how that is going to work. And that's the important thing. It's only tomorrow that you have that.
Yeah.
No, for 3 already. We wanted 3 names. I thought it's 5, but if there is somebody available, we can juggle around amongst the two. But it was, we had only the 3 names.
Oh.
Yeah. Okay. No, thanks very much. The dinner is just announced that there will be a dinner served at the old assembly dining hall ground floor, and then tomorrow the meeting is not starting.
Oh.
And 46 9 8 as well was that. Thanks very much. M46 not well.
Hello.
Yeah,
I'm not sure.